nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Introduce our speaker, who is Dr. Kevin White. He's currently the James and Karen Frank Family Professor at the Department of Human Genetics, Ecology and Evolution and Medicine at the University of Chicago. He's also the director of the Institute for Genomics and System Biology at the University of Chicago and the Arbonne National Lab. Kevin received his graduate with a BS and Master combined degree from the University of Yale, magna cum laude, in 1993. He then received a PhD in developmental biology from Stanford University in 1998. Then he did a 3 years postdoc at the Stanford Genome and Technology Center, and in 2001 he joined the faculty at Yale University as an assistant professor of genetics, and then was promoted associate professor in 2003. Then in 2006 he joined the faculty of the University of Chicago. Now, Kevin is a very distinguished researcher in the area of system biology and genomics. He received several important awards, including being named the NIH Genome Scholar in 2000. He received the W.M. Keck Distinguished Young Investigator Award in Medical Science in 2003, and many others. So now, you may wonder, why Cyber Center, which we really deal with cyber, has invited Kevin. But let me say that Kevin has been really at the frontier of using computational tools together with experimental methodologies in his research area. So even though whenever we discuss, he always defers to his IT people when we ask questions about how do you manage this data. He knows really a lot. It's really a pleasure to talk to him. And so basically, and especially a lot of his research has been focused on understanding gene networks and how they behave and influence each other. So without saying much more, I'll give the floor to Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Elisa, for the invite. And so actually, I've tried to tune my talk to be a little bit more cyber-centric, so to speak. And hopefully it will. So how many people in here are computer scientists or bioinformaticians or cyber people? And how many would call themselves cancer biologists? A few. Okay. And how many are the systems or genomics or other biology types? Okay. So we got a real mix of people here. I will try to entertain you all. So the title of today's talk is going to be Big Data Biology. First, I just wanted to throw a pitch out here since I'm at Purdue, and I know that at Purdue you're very strong in engineering and in computational sciences as well as the biological sciences. And what we have at the University of Chicago and at Argonne National Laboratory is this institute for genomics and systems biology, and actually right now we're very interested in hiring staff and postdocs in the area of computational sciences and biology and the interface thereof. And so we're looking for students who are currently thinking that they might go in the direction of dealing with some of the types of things I'm going to talk about today, dealing with large-scale data sets and analyzing large-scale data sets, building algorithms and to analyze large data and so forth. So what I'm going to start out talking today is about big data, and I think big data means different things to different people. And big data keeps getting bigger. You know, a couple of years ago, I think big data was like petascale, maybe not too long ago. And I think if you'd say today, exascale and up, zettascale is what the people at Argonne are starting to talk about. And so we'll get into what those are in a minute. But for those of you that don't know, for the cancer biologists, big data has been used in all sorts of different fields to some astounding results. Everything from internet marketing, where it's used, you know, Google and Facebook and so forth are computing over hundreds of petabytes of data, every second, and they're figuring out what you're going to click on next, and where you live, and who you know, and they're sending direct marketing to you. And some of the best minds in the country have been applying themselves to figuring out how to sell you stuff using big data. It's used in physics and astronomy, finance, you know, before the stock market crash or whatever it was, the recession that we went through, where the stock market blew up and now it's kind of back. But there was a big influx of people over maybe a 15-year period of some of the best quantitative minds going to Wall Street and building algorithms that ran over large data sets and just figured out how to pick quarters off the floor or pennies off the floor, because they would trade a nanosecond ahead of somebody else. And there's still, you know, a lot of that going on, although it's sort of at a stalemate now. And so these people have been moving into other areas, such as social networks and internet marketing and so forth. And big data has always been important in science. And I guess what the thesis of today's talk is going to be about is how it's about to take over biology and medicine as well. And the overall vision that we have at the Institute for Genomics and Systems Biology, and I think that a lot of people in the field are now having, is the idea that there's lots of important medical information and lots of genome kind of information that could be mined and used to extract new information about what are druggable targets, what are predictive outcomes if you can match specific patients to specific drugs, and what are the preventative measures that one could take if you had the appropriate knowledge of what's in your genome and what's in your medical record and what you're buying on eBay and so forth. And the idea is to basically have a cloud computing type and high performance computing type infrastructure that allow you to make those predictions, feed back to the patient, get more data, and create a hopefully virtuous cycle. So what do we mean by big data in biology? And what I'm going to show you in the next few slides is what I think is really the root of big data in biomedicine, and that's the hyper-exponential growth of DNA sequencing. So this is the number of base pairs on the right-hand side of this chart that were in GenBank, which is a national storage bank for DNA sequence data, up until about 2005. And you can see that it's growing at a very fast clip. By 2005, there are about 50 billion base pairs or so. So a few years ago, quite a number of years ago now, I was asked to give a presentation by the NSF on sort of where this was going and what systems biology was and these sort of topics. And I did something very silly. I just fit that curve and I extrapolated out what would this curve look like if it just kept going approximately the way it had been over the previous 25 years. And I got this curve, which is log 10 billions now of base pairs. And actually, if we look at where we are at the end of 2010, we're still on this curve. Okay, so we're at about 10 to the 4th billion base pairs. The actual number that have been sequenced is more in this range, and these are the processed base pairs. So in a couple of years, we're going to hit an exabyte of what's available. And within our lifetimes, we're going to hit a zettabyte, if this is, which is 1,000 exabytes. An exabyte is 1,000 petabytes, and a petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. And it's a lot of data. It's much more data than Google deals with currently. And you can play these fun games then if you believe that we're going to stay on track. In Chicago, we have about 3 million people in the downtown area. You know, Chicago metropolitan area is probably more like, you know, 8 or 10 or something like that. But the downtown area is 3 million. We'd be able to sequence everybody in Chicago by 2016. If you look at the diversity on Earth, I skipped a slide here, but E.O. Wilson and colleagues have basically made estimates of how many of each genera, of each types of species there are on planet Earth from biodiversity surveys. And you can take that times the number of base pairs that each one of those species has been measured to have. So each group of species, people have measured the amount of DNA in their cells to a pretty good accuracy, and you can multiply those two, and you can ask at what point in time would we be able to have a catalog of all 100 million species on Earth if we were to collect them. You can also look at the world population. You can ask, when does the world population expansion intersect with our capacity to sequence everybody on the planet? And that will be around 2060. Now, I'm not saying that this is all going to happen this way. I'm saying that if the growth in this technology, which is driven by basically cheap sequencing and advances in nanotechnology and physics and as applied to DNA sequencing, if it continues at the rate it is now, everybody in this room at some point is going to have their genome sequenced as a routine part of their care. Already at the University of Chicago, we're sequencing at least parts of genomes of cancer patients that come in. Okay, and I think around the country, this is a growing trend in biomedicine. So the data drivers are not just, although it's the root, it's not just genome sequencing, but of course there's massive amounts of imaging data in biomedicine. There's other genomes. There's all those other species that are being sequenced. Whenever we make a prediction about a particular nucleotide in the human genome and whether that nucleotide, if it's changed in a person that has a particular disease, whether that nucleotide might be relevant, we compare it to the data from dozens of other species, and we ask how conserved it is. We're also going to be looking at microbiota. You know, there's more cells that are of microbial type on and in our bodies than there are cells that compose our bodies. So more and more researchers have been showing that the microbiota that's interacting with us is having major influence on just about every trait and health component that we have. There's literature, there's mining medical records. And this is only going to be one part of the overall picture where there's all these large-scale projects like Cancer Genome Atlas, Thousand Genome Project. There's just about every disease that's out there. They're doing sequencing now of the coding part of the human genome, and they're determining what those sequences are in thousands and thousands of people. comparing them to controls. There's the ENCODE project. There's all these different projects that are annotating the human genome in various contexts. And so those will be useful. And then there's orthogonal data. I sort of mentioned before what you buy on eBay. It's actually not, I wasn't joking. So you can imagine building algorithms that take the genome data, take all of your medical record data, but also look at how many times did you eat at McDonald's in the last 3 years. What are your shopping patterns? What are you buying and bringing into the home? What sort of sites are you surfing on the internet? And all that sort of information. Who are you connected to? All that kind of information can help determine what the likelihood is that you're going to get sick from X, Y, or Z disease. So a simple way of thinking, people are familiar with Zynga, and this company that builds the games, so they're keeping track of lots of data, right? So one of the risk factors for diabetes, for cancer, is sedentary behavior. So you could just look at how many hours people are logging sitting there gaming. And that would be, one would expect, predictive of how likely you were to get sick of some of those diseases. So if this is what's coming, what are we going to need in terms of infrastructure, computing infrastructure, to deal with it? So a 10 terabyte hard drive can hold about 20 human genomes. So in 2016, we expect about 100 terabyte hard drives to hold 200 genomes. And we'll need, because this is going up more slowly than the genome sequencing, but it is increasing the storage capacity. But you'll need about 1,500 petabytes or 1.5 exabytes or 15,000 of these hard drives. So that's quite a few racks that you would have to have in your data center. It's all very doable. As this expands, it's going to get bigger and bigger. And although it's doable, Google has a big budget. I'm sure that they probably have already an exabyte of data. But they also have hundreds of millions of dollars to sink into their data centers to keep them cooled and powered up. And so this is actually going to become a significant issue. And that's pretty much what this slide is saying. So one of the projects that I'm part of to try to start thinking and addressing this problem is a nonprofit called the Open Science Data Cloud that's run by a guy named Bob Grossman, who's one of the faculty in my institute, and Joe Membretti, who's a faculty at Northwestern. And so the idea is that you would have these sort of interrelated clouds that could be distributed as long as they're distributed across a fast network, and I'll get to that in a second. But you have publicly available data, but then you have controlled data. For example, if you look at cancer data produced by the NIH, you have to have special credentials to look at that. And so you have to have a sort of cordoned off area to do that. And especially with clinical data right now, anything with private protected data through clinical record, you need sort of another level of security. And oftentimes institutions want to have that locally as well. And so you need to have a system that can be deployed across different sites and also interoperate and absorb all this data that's coming from different sources. And so we've been building such a system we call the BioNimbus Cloud. I don't think I actually have stats on it right now, but currently it's not all that big. It's less than a petabyte. Or maybe about a petabyte of storage, and it has, I think, right now around 5,000 or 6,000 cores of compute in it. We have it linked to some other high-performance machines so that we can move at least non-protected data onto, we have a Cray that has 18,000 processors, and we're writing workflows to analyze data over that and then shoot it back into the cloud. But the idea is to create a system that is actually fairly transparent to users so that you as a cancer biologist or as a plant biologist or whatever kind of biologist you are, you can access these massive amounts of data without having to download an exabyte of data and put it in your lab. Because if you download an exabyte of data and you have a live compute over it in your lab, it's going to cost you a few million dollars to do that. And you're going to have to hire some staff like systems administrators and people to keep the things humming, and then you're going to have to pay for all that operating expenses over time. And it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense for an individual investigator with two postdocs and a grad student. And so we'd like to build, imagine a day where this system is interoperating with the commercial sources, the genome centers, and so forth. We're already hooked up to some genome centers, the NCBI. We've got all the NCBI Amazon services are connected in. There's a number of users of this system already, and there have been papers published. This slide's a little bit outdated, but in the first pilot of this system, we had several groups already on it and using it. And we have a variety of pipelines that are used that I'll talk about in a bit. So the cloud that we're using, there's a site in Chicago. There's also some computers in San Diego that are hooked up to it and elsewhere. But the idea is, you know, you can have a distributed network of data centers as long as you've got 10 or 100 gigabit per second network. And so our stuff comes in through Starlight in Chicago, which is, you know, a hub internationally for high bandwidth private networks for science. Last year, NCBI had more than 2 petabytes of data. Most of that was sequence data, and we've taken in all but the sequence data from NCBI. And I'll show you some of the data that we're going to be hosting in this cloud in a moment that's sequenced. But again, big data biology, what do I mean by that? Think of it as an emerging discipline where we can study how to extract useful information from all possible information or data generated from biology. An example of the sort of thing, very simple thing, that you might be able to do in this kind of field is represented by Google Flu. Many of you may know about Google Flu already. They just keep track of certain kind of queries, and then they have an algorithm that predicts where you're going to have outbreaks and when the flu is going to hit. And so it turns out this is very highly predictive and a heck of a lot cheaper than the United States Health Organization, which had a network of people out there at hospitals reporting back, and they're trying to coordinate all this information. So just by looking at people's searches, they've been able to get ahead of that. And I think that the CDC is now essentially using this kind of method. So here's Google Flu in Chicago, where I'm from. This is just the data showing what I told you. So this is the Google Flu being a couple weeks ahead of the CDC's reports. This is the 2009 H1N1 outbreak. They were able to predict that. So that's just a tiny little example, a little slice of the sort of thing that could be done. You know, one can imagine predicting all sorts of diseases, every possible disease, and I'll get into a few examples in a moment of how we're using this system. So the way I think of this, and I think the computer scientists have probably seen this kind of diagram many times, and I want to put this in the context of biology. So, you know, at the bottom of the pyramid is lots and lots of data, and you need to turn that data into information. And the way this happens in this context, in such volumes of data, is not through individual experiments in individual labs necessarily. It's going to involve automated and semi-automated systems for categorizing, assigning functions, turning the data from a bunch of data into something that's interpretable and can lead to testable hypotheses. Where you can test these hypotheses, build theories, develop new tools, create new knowledge, and then move it into clinical application through diagnostics and therapeutics. So I'm going to run through quickly the kind of data that we're going to have in this cloud over the next, say, 6 to 9 month period. And it's already launched. I think this week its initial version is coming out for public consumption. And so one of the things we're going to have is a cancer genome atlas. It's expected the cancer genome atlas will grow to about 3 to 5 petabytes in the next 14 months. It's a little bit under a petabyte right now. Target is similar to the cancer genome atlas. It's also cancer data, but it's for children. So there's a pediatric cancer database. It's somewhat smaller. It's about half a petabyte expected. Right now, it's less than 100 terabytes. There's a 1,000 genomes project, which is more than 1,000 genomes now. That's already loaded into the cloud, as well as a lot of the NHLBI. This is Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. They're running a number of studies on things like heart disease, certain types of lung disease, asthma, and these sorts of things. And they're sequencing thousands and thousands of genomes as part of that. The ENCODE data, there's a project called Encyclopedia of DNA Elements that my lab is part of, and I'm not going to talk about our contributions to that today, but essentially the goal of that project is to annotate the human genome. And so it's using other kinds of data other than sequence data, data such as mapping where transcription factors bind or where chromatin marks are. The chromatin is what wraps the genome up and creates structure in the genome. And so there's about $100 million project dedicated to that. And so there's massive amounts of data that have been and will continue to be produced to annotate the human genome. There's data such as the pharmacological effects of genetic polymorphisms and how they relate to pharmacology. And of course, there's electronic medical records. And so I'll talk about some of these things in the rest of my talk, where I'd like to take you through some example applications. So a lot of what our institute does is focus on building networks and mining networks, often from very heterogeneous data. Each of these data types has can be quite voluminous, and each of these data types has typically its own set of statistical methods and models for trying to determine what are true positives, what are false positives, you know, what can you rely on, what's the probability of any particular scrap of data within a large data set that you produce being true. And so we do a lot of work on integrating and building predictive models from complicated data sets. And I'm going to take you through a couple of examples where we've done either a bit of integration or we've had to analyze very large sets of data. So The first example is something we call the Chicago Cancer Genomes Project, which sort of expanded out and sucked in the Cancer Genome Atlas that the U.S. government is funding, which is a $500 million project to sequence thousands of tumors that I mentioned before. And what we're doing in Chicago is we've taken the approach of getting together clinical fellows. So these are MD, PhDs that come into our institute, and they want to do a few years of training. And they're interested in cancer biology. And Tom has already moved on to Vanderbilt, where he's heading up a program there. It's somewhat similar. And David and Megan are still in IGSB and finishing their fellowships. And what Tom and David and Megan have done is they've coordinated many different groups that have specific sets of questions that they want to ask about their patients. And so these different clinical investigators have patients that maybe respond to drugs or are more sensitive to drugs, or have a differential outcome, or more likely to have aggressive disease or less aggressive disease. And we have a lot of stories that have been emerging from our analyses here. I want to tell you about basically just one or two of them. So the area I want to focus on in this example is gene fusions. So we have been developing ways to systematically identify gene fusions. And I'll tell you why we think that's interesting. So cancer genomes are highly rearranged. This is just a handful of tumor types and showing the extent to which they have different chromosomal rearrangements or chromosomal aberrations such as deletions. This is where big chunks of the genome are basically getting broken up, chopped up, and moved around. And so these are pretty major, or can lead to pretty major consequences. Yes.
Does this not depend on the stage of the cancer?
Indeed, it can. Yeah. And so.
What stage are you looking at? Are you looking at a common stage?
Really, the question is, which of these hundreds of tumors are you asking about?
So
most of these tumors are basically primary tumors. And not metastatic tumors, but they will be a variety of, you know, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4, or prostate, you know, different Gleason scores. Are you a clinical pathologist?
No, I'm a
clinician. Oh, okay. Yeah. So there's different like ways of staging tumors. Different tumor types have, you know, different sort of traditions and so forth, and. Most of the tumors that would be done here, of course, it's disease specific because some things like breast nowadays are catching them much earlier than you would something like pancreatic cancer or kidney cancer, which is often never detected until stage 4. So it is heterogeneous, this group of tumors. And dependent on type. But regardless, all I really want to show here is there's a high degree, you know, some of these tumors have hundreds and hundreds individually of rearrangements in their genomes. And some of those rearrangements can lead to actual fusion of genes.
So the control would be a
germline.
A healthy tissue.
Yes.
Of the
either adjacent normal tissue or blood.
Yeah. And you would not see the respective fusions and so on and so forth at all.
That is, in theory, the case. And we are working with Peter Van Loo at the Sanger Center to try to develop better algorithms to weed out what is germline and what is not germline. But there's a method he calls ASCAT that is looking at copy number variation and so forth. And when you're dealing with the scale of data that we're dealing with, you don't get 100% accuracy. accuracy, right? And so what we can say is we have a, you know, true positive and true and a false positive rates, and that the majority of the variants that you see are not just variants that are in the germline. Especially like the chromosomal inversions and the, so, you know, it moving, so if you move part of chromosome 5 to chromosome 7, that's not, that, I mean, that's not happening in our germline. I mean, it's happening in our germline, but it's not leading to viable offspring.
So when these cancers are observed, essentially every one, or what percentage doesn't show a rearrangement? Or is, you know, some don't?
Yeah, so some do not, and it's very, it's dependent on the type of cancer. So, you know, ovarian cancers, for example, show a high degree of rearrangements. Even on this chart, you'll see heterogeneity. So you see, you know, the multiple myelomas tend to be less so than, say, the prostate. So, but in terms of how frequently do you find absolutely no chromosomal abnormalities? That's actually fairly low, particularly when we start looking at a finer scale. I can't give you a specific number without diving into the, doing a search, a query. But so oftentimes, often enough for it to be important biologically and therapeutically, these rearrangements, they lead to fusion genes, genes that were never meant to be by nature, let's say. And they fall into sort of different categories. So you can have a process fusion transcript that retains the intron and maybe has splicing, but maybe that splicing may or may not lead to a functional or in-frame product. The processed fusion may include just a partial exon that, again, can lead to an early stop and cause a reduction of function of the particular gene products that are involved. And so those often lead to tumor suppressor situations. Another possibility is that they get properly processed and you get transcripts with intact coding domains. So you get basically a real fusion gene that has two different proteins that are spliced together to create a novel protein. And another possibility is that you just fuse the regulatory regions so that you overexpress something like the c-MYC gene, which if you overexpress c-MYC, you can drive proliferation. So the classic example is the BCR-ABL fusion in CML, where you basically have a fusion to the this tyrosine kinase, and that drives the tumorigenesis, and there's an inhibitor of the tyrosine kinase, imatinib, that basically cures the disease, at least in for a while before it becomes resistant. So there are a lot of known recurrent fusions of this second type, and many of them actually are druggable. And so we were interested in starting to mine the volumes of data that were coming out from RNA-seq in particular to identify fusions. So about 15% of reads in an RNA-seq assay are discordantly mapped. That means that they map to more than one site. And so you know, that's not the level at which there are actual fusions. There's a huge amount of noise in there. The biggest trick we use to try to sort signal from noise is we look for junction mapping reads. That's reads that span across two exons that belong to two different genes. Basically, what we do with our algorithm is we align to all isoforms of all genes, each piece of DNA, then we trim it, align it to the latest genome assembly. We build discordant read clusters, So we have clusters of discordant reads between genes. Then we apply various filters, including this exon-exon junction. We align anything to unmap reads to the junctions, any of the unmap reads to the junction, and then we filter with, again, several different types of filters. And so what we end up with is a workflow that's all coded into, I guess, a series of scripts that allow us to systematically identify fusion genes from any RNA-seq experiment. And so we started out with, just from the Chicago group, we have around 500 tumors that have been processed this way. And I'm going to show you some data from specific tumor types that we've done from the Cancer Genome Atlas. But there are a total of around 7,000 in the databases right now that we're sort of systematically running this process through. We used a cell line called MCF7 cells. It's a breast cancer cell line as a control, where 57 fusions were previously identified through a variety of methods. And we basically asked with our algorithm, how many are true positives? So how many of these 57 do we actually find? And we find about half of them. And then we find a few that were not previously identified with this algorithm. And we compared to several other algorithms that are out there. And one of the things you can see from our algorithm is we have a relatively low number of previously unknown. And all of our previously unknown four out of seven are called by at least three of these other methods. So we think that the specificity of our algorithm is very high. Our sensitivity is going to take a hit because of that. Most of the other algorithms have low sensitivity. So you see, like, this one here is finding many, many previously unknown, and a good fraction of those are just going to be false positives. And so because there's so many of these in each cell, and this sort of gets to the question of, you know, how often do you see nothing? Not very often. You want something that's very sensitive. It's very specific. So now here we've looked at an ovarian primary tumor from a patient at the University of Chicago. We had 127 million 2x100 reads. So, you know, right there we're talking about many gigabytes of data from this one patient. And this is how our algorithm performs. This is how now we've added a few other algorithms that are out there. And these singletons are the ones you want to avoid. And these three or more methods are the ones that you want to try to get. So we like this algorithm. It just has a high amount of singletons. And this diffuse is pretty good as well. These are particular gene fusions that were found, and in fact, this one, ELL to this gene SMARCA4, ELL is a gene fusion that's normally found in leukemias, and so we find it here in this particular ovarian tumor, and so this is possibly driving the tumorigenesis. We're testing that now. Now, we looked at several hundred high-grade ovarian cancers from our data and from the national project. The thing is that when we started this, there were no known recurrent fusions. That is, there are no known fusions that happen over and over again in these tumors. And we looked at a total of 420 from this database. We did this in collaboration with the British Columbia Cancer Agency, Andy Mungle, and we compared their method, which is called TransAbyss, which is different than our method. Ours looks at RNA, and theirs looks at genome data, largely. And we found about 2,341 that we're calling our set that we'll take further because both algorithms called it. Of those, we see One in particular, this MECOM MDS and EVE of one fusion that is in an appreciable number of samples, about 3.5% of all the tumors have this particular fusion. And the promising thing here is that this can be targeted by FDA-approved compounds already. And so we're pretty excited about this particular discovery. So by basically looking at hundreds and hundreds of tumors, taking a couple of algorithms and running them in our infrastructure, you know, in a matter of a week or something, we went from having the data downloaded to making a new discovery that could lead to a new clinical trial. We recently published a paper in the journal Blood on which is one of the major journals that people use to publish their findings in leukemia and lymphoma, where for 40 years people were looking for a tumor suppressor that was on chromosome 7 and associated with a high proportion of myeloid diseases. We were able to actually use this fusion algorithm to narrow it down to one gene, CUX1, that happened to be within the minimal interval that was deleted among hundreds of patients. In this case, we only need 35 patients to find that minimal interval, but that minimal interval only got us down to a dozen or so genes. And so it turned out one patient from the University of Chicago who we sequenced didn't have any large deletions that we could map by traditional methods, but by running it through our algorithm, we found we found that CUX1, this particular gene, which is a homeodomain protein for the developmental biologists in the audience, had a micro rearrangement that led to a non-functional product. And so what we did is we knocked it down specifically in the fruit fly hematocytes, the fruit fly blood cells, and it gave the fruit flies blood cancer. And then we took human hematopoietic stem cells from bone marrow, and we knocked the same gene, which is highly conserved between fly and human, we knocked it down in the human stem cells, and we put the human stem cells into immunocompromised mice, and they engrafted and again showed proliferation. And so we think after 40 years, we've actually found a tumor suppressor or at least one tumor suppressor that's in that minimal interval that people have been searching for. And again, this all happened in the matter of, you know, a couple of months once we had the data. Okay, so the second example I'm going to use is what I'll refer to as quantitative mapping of genetic interactions by combinatorial RNAi in cells. So for the computer scientists who don't know what combinatorial RNA is, it's a method by which we can use essentially small RNA molecules that are targeted against particular gene products, okay? And then it utilizes the cell's own internal machinery for chopping up those internal those gene products and essentially creating the equivalent of a mutation. Okay, it's a little bit dirty, but we'll think of it as equivalent of a mutation. And so, what we want to do is we want to ask, if I have gene A and I get a phenotype, like let's say the phenotype is red, so I get gene A and it's red, and I knock down gene B and it's blue. If I put gene A and B together, my prediction might be that you get purple. Okay? If they have a simple relationship. But if they don't have a simple relationship, you might get something like in between purple and red, or in between blue and purple, or bluer than blue, or redder than red. When that happens, we call that a genetic interaction by a quantitative genetic interaction. So, and some people who are quantitative geneticists would call that an epistasis. And developmental geneticists would not call that epistasis because they call something else epistasis, but I won't get into that. So what we did is we went back to the genome data to get started on this project. And hopefully you'll see why I just told you that by the time I'm through this example. So we looked at breast cancer data, 536 tumor normal pairs from patients, and we looked at expression level, we looked at somatic mutations, we looked at copy number variants. So these are these things I've been mentioning before we looked at again, and we built a little algorithm to look at that. And we hypothesized that co-mutated genes in a tumor are more likely to act together in the development of the cancer. And so how do you tell if two things are interacting genetically? You go to this RNAi system. And so, but the first thing we did is we mined the data to see of the tens of thousands, actually tens of millions of possible interactions, which interactions might we want to actually go and do an experiment with in the lab? So we looked, our algorithm took concordant expression change. I don't know if we build a gene matrix. We applied filters and so forth. I'm happy to talk about this afterwards, but we narrowed it down to 122 candidate genes that we wanted to look at a matrix of interactions from. And after pre-screening for good siRNAs, we got down to 66. So we went from, so the number of interactions we can map now is 66 squared, right? So we went from something like 20,000 by 20,000 matrix to 66 by 66 matrix. So this is what I was saying before, and this is one way to calculate it. That it, you know, if you have no interaction, basically, there's no percentages on here. Is there a percentage? Okay. So, oh, there are. They're dark. Okay. So let's say you had an 80% effect on the phenotype. So this is wild type over wild type. This is wild type over the RNAi mutant. So 80% here for gene B. Gene A, you have 60%, so you can ask if you get the product is 48%, then there'd be no interaction. But if you have more, then it would be an alleviating interaction. If it's less, it would be an aggravating interaction, okay? So we're looking for those interactions. So back to this. So after doing the knockdowns, what we do is high content imaging. We have a robot and a microscope. And the robot moves the plates around, and then we have it moves it to other robots that put the RNAs into the plates so that we can do screen, you know, tens of thousands of interactions if we need to. Then once they've been treated with this reagent, they go to a box that has a microscope in it, and then it takes lots and lots of pictures and puts them on a hard drive that is hooked up to the cloud and moves the data over to the cloud. And then we basically image these cells. And we have programs that can draw outlines around the cells to get the cell shape, around the nucleus to get the nuclear shape, and to get the cell and nuclear volumes. And there you go. Isn't that pretty? And sometimes you get phenotypes where this, you know, where there's quite dramatic effects on the cells. And so all by using this imaging software, we're able to extract cell by cell data on shape and size and so forth. And then we can look at, for example, how well it's correlating across replicates. So here's cell number, nuclear size, nucleus eccentricity. That's how much the, you know, how oblong and how bending they are. And then we basically apply the statistic and we ask, what about genetic interactions? And so you see in cell number, we have a very large number of interactions of the 66 by 6 matrix, 66 matrix. Cell size a little bit less and nuclear size a little bit less than that. And there are a subset that have all three are affected. So then we look at the, I'm going to take you just through a couple, for the biologists in the room, a couple examples just to convince you, hopefully, that what we're looking at is not just a bogus statistical interaction. So here's an example of two known interactors, MCPH and BRCA2, that are involved in DNA damage. And they're known to have protein-protein interactions. So we find examples of protein-protein interactions that are known. We find examples of post-translational modifications where these interact. We find examples of molecular competition, in this case for binding and changing of this chromatin state, that how the chromosomes are packaged that I mentioned early in the seminar. Here's a regulatory interaction where it's known that this gene regulates this gene, or this protein regulates this gene, and they interact together. And so we're seeing lots of examples of known interactions, and we're seeing, of course, then lots of examples of new things. We can also look at things, we can look at these interactions in aggregate. So here's a set of interactions. All of these are known to be involved in DNA repair. And these are MAP kinase pathway. MAP kinase pathway is a very important pathway in cancer and is often mutated. So these are interacting. So we're seeing pathway interactions by looking at things in aggregate. These are known to both control junk activation, which is important for survival and apoptosis of cells. So, and this is sort of the last thing, sort of the punchline. So what I've shown you so far is that there are interactions that we can detect statistically in the data, so that you see more often than you expect, if you look at hundreds and hundreds of tumors, that gene A and gene B are co-mutated. Then we say, okay, well, is that real biologically? So as a first step, we take it into the cells and we ask whether there's just statistical genetic interactions. And then if it makes that level, we ask the following thing. So this is a case where we see a genetic interaction. We saw that these things are, these two particular genes are co-mutated in patients. And then we can actually go and ask, what happens to those patients if we have survival data? So here now we're looking at survival of the patients. So if you have just this particular gene mutated, so this is estimated survival time in months, and this is a probability of survival on this axis. And so if you don't have any of these mutants, you follow this red line. If you have the SS18L1, you follow the blue. The MAP2 kinase is in pink, but if you have the double mutation, now these are interacting in the patient. So they're actually, so in model organisms, there's something called synthetic lethal. When you have one mutation, you don't get lethality. If you have a mutation in another gene at another locus, when they come together, they get lethality. And this often ends up being some molecular interaction, like the many examples I gave you before. In this case, it's quite literally lethality that we're measuring in people. And the lethality is due not to, like in a model organism, where you would have two genes that are required for the development, but in this case, it's two genes that are causing the tumor to become more aggressive and thereby lead to the death of the patients. So I hope you can see that if one can drug either of those two mutations in a way that brings it back up, then this set of patients has a higher probability of survival. And what we're doing currently is we're taking these same populations of patients that were sequenced that were looked at using common alleles, and we're sequencing the Mendelian code genes, or we're just downloading them from the various projects and sifting through and focusing in on the Mendelian code genes and looking for deleterious variants by comparing across many other species. As I mentioned earlier, one can make predictions about what parts of a gene might be important, and if there are variants there, whether that may have structural functional significance. Okay, so I'm just going to end with this back to the beginning. I really think that we're moving into an era of big data biology. I think by using these genomics and systems level techniques, we're going to be able to marry these techniques with the computing in order to accelerate the development and delivery of diagnostic and therapeutic solutions to patients. I want to acknowledge the people in blue were involved in the cancer project I told you about, the two cancer projects I told you about. Andre and David, Andre conceived of this Mendelian code thing to begin with, and it was a great collaboration as we figured out how to do both the math and how to test the hypothesis using the genetic data, and so that's been a lot of fun. And Bob Grossman is my partner in crime with the BioNimbus cloud. Andy and Rianne were involved with us in the collaboration that I talked about with ovarian cancers. So I'll stop there.